On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's our last episode of the year, so of course we're going to spend it highlighting some of our favorite moments of 2015. And who better to kick us off than a familiar voice, Mr. Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and an invaluable part of our Good Food team. Today, he joins us for a look back at the year's top 10 dishes.
The first, not necessarily in order, was the foie gras funnel cake at the new Odeum.
Foie gras funnel cake.
Right.
Okay, so first describe what a funnel cake is for the three people who have never been to a county fair.
A funnel cake is total county fair food. It's basically like batter that's squirted into hot fat in a crisscross section. Then they take it off and pile goop on it. Timothy Hollingsworth, who was the chef de cuisine at French Laundry for a million years, is down here. He's doing it. He's taking the funnel cake in his splendid new restaurant next to the Broad Museum. He's putting strawberries on it, shaved fennel, and little delicate airy puffs of foie gras mousse.
That has to be just sumptuous.
It's mind-blowingly good, and it also in some ways seems to signal the end of Western civilization. Because where do you go from there? I mean, it's like you're going to do your freaking food. You're going to do your cronut. Okay, I will up your cronut and give you foie gras funnel cake. Well done, Mr. Hollingsworth.
Okay.
Number two would be the feu pot au feu from Casilla, which we've talked about on this show, that being Brian Eng's restaurant, the sort of French Vietnamese. And he manages to get all the sort of beautiful, homey cuisine bourgeois aspects of the pot au feu, which is the cornerstone of French home cooking, and bring it into a Vietnamese context with the different spicing and with the aromas that you would associate with pho. In a way, he's sort of colonizing the colonizers, which is beautiful. The third is the cauliflower and millet from Otis and Penelope.
Wow, we have just gone in a wildly different direction. I love it. I love it.
Hey, it's gluten-free.
Hey, yeah.
But, you know, everybody thinks of Otis and Penelope, the restaurant of Quinn and Karen Hatfield, for, you know, A, Karen Hatfield's amazing desserts, and B, you know, Quinn Hatfield's prowess on the grill with his Brazilian-style churrascaria dishes. But to me, the most fascinating dish there is this, like, little bowl of cauliflower and millet.
And it's a thing in a bowl.
And it's a thing in a bowl. There's the pomelo salad of garlic and chives, which is Kristen Nguyen's new Vietnamese restaurant in Westminster. It's pomelo, which is like, you know, beautiful, sweet grapefruit kind of thing, tossed with roasted peanuts, a little banana blossom, a little fish sauce, a really nice dish. The fideo from Colonia Publica, which we've talked about, which is, you know, the delicious sort of
noodle paella.
It's a noodle paella, Mexican style. You get to pick the ingredients to put in it. It's completely delicious. It's a reason to go to Whittier. You know, there's a lot of dishes between Pak Pak Pad Thai and the new sort of mothership Pak Pak that opened in Chinatown. But I'm really in love with the Pad Thai, which is a soft noodle. It's slow cooked in a little bit of lard. It has a spiciness to it and a presence, but the interesting thing about it is that you're obligated to flavor it by yourself with fish sauce, chili vinegar, sugar, and dried chilies. And in doing that and experimenting, you sort of begin to realize how Thai chefs build flavors. And in the understanding that you suddenly have in a really visceral way you didn't have before, you start to appreciate not just Ricker's Thai cuisine, but sort of all Thai cooking. It's pretty good for a $10 plate of noodles.
So what else? Give us another highlight.
We're at Kinjiro now, which is izakaya downtown. And I think probably the exemplary dish there, or the one that blew me away, is the bone marrow dengaku.
What is dengaku?
Dengaku, or natsu dengaku, is a Japanese izakaya dish of eggplants that have been, you know, brushed with thick sweet miso and broiled until they become super crunchy. Here they do the same thing with bone marrow. And bone marrow becomes soft and half molten and just totally delicious under this treatment. You will not be surprised to learn that Noruk is on this list.
Noruk from Baru.
Noruk from Baru. It sounds like we're talking Klingon or something, doesn't it?
I love that place.
It's a wonderful new restaurant. It's the future of cuisine. And Noruk is that big plate of pink moldy vegetables that taste so good.
Really good.
The kinkali.
The jigundo dumplings.
They're so big that they have actual handles that you use to sort of guide them to your mouth.
And so what restaurant did you find these kinkali?
You can find the kinkali at Tumanyan Kinkali Factory, or TKF for short.
So now, Jonathan, we come to the last dish.
Okay. And again, not in order, because this is the absolutely essential dish in Los Angeles this year, I believe, is the clam lardo tacos from BS Taqueria.
Those are mighty fine.
He makes the tortilla from that
blue heirloom corn,
which is so good. There is actually lardo in it, so there's this sort of like haunting porkiness. There are clams in it. Little bit of gremolata, which you wouldn't expect in a taco, but it's there with the lardo. And it's just a perfect bite.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And if you text the words good food to 69866 right now, we'll send you a list of all the dishes and restaurants that Jonathan just mentioned. Up next, we dive into some of our favorite interviews and stories from 2015, from the most famous butcher in the world to ice cream in Mogadishu. Stay close.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman, and today we're looking back at our favorite segments from 2015.
Un giovane macellaio comincia a 13 anni.
A young butcher starts off around 13 years in Italy.
A 13 anni, un adolescente sogna tutto nella vita.
And a 13-year-old, as you know, dreams of just about anything in life other than taking over his dad's work. Knowing that there were seven generations passed down from father to son ahead of me was nearly a nightmare. But I'd grown up in the shop. I was born in the house across the street from the butcher shop. And that little piece of the world, the house, the narrow road, the shop across the street, that was my world.
Dario Cecchini didn't want to be a butcher, yet he has become, without argument, the most famous butcher in the world. He lives and works in Panzano, a small town in Tuscany where he runs the local butcher shop, just as his family has done for seven generations before him. But he doesn't live a small town life. Antica Macelleria Cecchini is a place of pilgrimage for people who love great food from all over the world. It's a place where you're as likely to find opera as you are AC/DC blasting through the stereo. Dario joins me this morning with his wife, Kim, who will be his translator today. Benvenuto.
Grazie.
It's wonderful to have you. So when your father died, I understand that you were studying actually to be a veterinarian, which is a very interesting choice coming as the son of butchers.
Era una scelta che apparteneva a quel mondo.
In a way, it was a choice that made sense within that world because it was my desire to help people who raised animals that we used to raise them better and to help them have a better life.
Era interessante anche perché
in the countryside, a veterinarian in the end took care of not only the animals, but also the simple folk who took care of those animals. And so veterinarians were very often people doctors, and my veterinarian that I knew was my doctor.
So this moment happens where you watch your father fall ill, the one person you had left, and you yourself make the decision to step into that shop. Was it a decision that you were finally able to make with total surrender, or did you fight yourself a lot when you first went in there?
Era un obbligo.
It was an obligation.
E come tutti gli obblighi, non era una scelta.
It was not a choice. It was a moment that I had to accept the path that life had dealt me and to give up my dream.
What was your dream at that point?
Il mio sogno era di diventare un veterinario.
I dreamed of becoming a veterinarian and to having a life that was different from the life that my parents had led.
Have had all of these generations before you in the butcher shop, had it always been a nose-to-tail operation?
Hanno fatto dal naso alla coda perché era necessario, perché
nose-to-tail was something that happened naturally back then. The richer folks in town bought the fillets, they bought the steaks, and the poor folks in town bought most of the rest. Because little town, small market, it just worked out naturally that way. The only way we knew was nose-to-tail.
In the shop, you don't only sell raw meat, like many butchers do, but you also sell food that's been cooked.
C'è il negozio e ci sono due ristoranti insieme al negozio.
So in the shop we sell some parts of the animal and other parts of the animal. We cook and we serve in our two restaurants. And this way we're able to use the whole animal well. A butcher takes on the responsibility for the entire community of killing. Butchery represents the most delicate link in the food chain. It's the biggest responsibility maybe that anyone in the food world takes on. For me, that responsibility starts with thinking about the life of the animal and guaranteeing that it has good space, a good life, good food. That the animal then has as compassionate a death as possible and that every part of the animal is used in the best way. But that's not enough. We always have to remember to thank the animal for the gift it's given us. And for me, the best way to thank the animal is to share the meat that the animal has given us at a convivial table all together. In our restaurants, we sit down all together at the same time with one menu, and it's a set price. This is my way of creating a sharing environment for dining together. It's a Renaissance tradition, really, a celebration of life.
When people come into the shop to buy a bistecca fiorentina, do you make them purchase another part of the animal?
Io non impongo, cerco di spiegare.
I don't make them, I try to explain. If somebody wants a bistecca alla fiorentina, I ask that they telephone ahead and give me a couple of days of time to set one aside for them. The bistecca alla fiorentina is just one part of the entire animal. And so I do ask that people, when they purchase a bistecca alla fiorentina, that they also walk away with a bistecca panzanese, which is a special cut from panzano. I consider both of these cuts to be noble cuts. They're both fantastic, cooked on a grill. The clients seem to appreciate that we together are taking responsibility. And I think that this helps them to recognize that the quality that they find in my shop doesn't have only to do with the meat, but also with the service and the thought behind the service. I explain this dilemma to my clients, and that allows them to become part of the solution. I explain that the dilemma is
to beef or no to beef.
Is there a cut of any animal, not just beef, that you would love Americans to know about and use more?
Vorrei che tutti
What I would like is that Americans, but not only Americans, recognize that the world of meat is not shaped like a pyramid, where the very tip of the triangle is a filet, a fancy steak, and that somehow as you move through the other cuts of the animal, you're finding cuts that are less good. I would rather prefer that they think of meat as a harmonic circle, where every single cut is equally excellent if it's cooked well. One of my favorite recipes that we cook and serve in our restaurant is called tenerumi in insalata. It's a boiled beef salad. I start with beef knees, and I boil them in the simplest way possible with carrot, onion, and celery. I then pull the meat off the bone, and I serve it as a warm salad with julienne, carrot, celery, and onion raw. I don't make a point of explaining this is boiled beef knees before my guests start eating. I come through, I say, "Did you enjoy that dish?" And they say, "It was fantastic. What the heck was it?" "Beef knees," I say. "It was just beef knees." And they say, "Oh, that's amazing. I had no idea you could even eat that." For me, this is part of the experience of coming to the butcher shop and sitting down for something to eat. It's not a voyage just grabbing your car and driving out there. It's a spiritual voyage even once you sit down. And maybe the people that come have a chance to find a harmony for themselves.
Thank you so much, Dario.
Grazie.
Dario Cecchini is an eighth-generation butcher. His shop, Antica Macelleria Cecchini, is in the small town of Panzano in the Chianti region of Italy. In Mauritania, breakfast in North Korea, Cairo's Chinatown. Armchair travel used to be about reading novels or the evocative guidebook. Now it's all about that image on Instagram or the Tumblr post that pushes you out of the chair and into the place. In the landscape of new media, no one's presenting everyday exotica more deeply than Roads and Kingdoms. Nathan Thordberg was a foreign correspondent for Time magazine. Now he's the chief editor and publisher of Roads and Kingdoms. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Evan.
Foreign correspondent, it's like the best title ever for launching an evocative travel site.
It's also an incredible job, which made it so weird that I quit to go start a Tumblr.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit. What was it about Time or old media that you were perhaps ready to leave? Or more importantly, what was it about new media that was so enticing?
I think one of the things for me personally was just the idea that we had incredible resources at Time magazine still. I was able to travel all around the world and interview any kind of person that I wanted to interview. What I was having were these incredible, not just kind of political stories that were coming out of it, but really travel experiences. And I felt at the end of the day, what was on the page at Time magazine didn't really reflect the fullness of what it's like to be out there in the world. When you come back from assignment, whether it's to Russia or Cuba or Israel or Turkey or wherever else in the world I was, the stories that I was told when I got home were not really about the interview or the policy issues, but it was about the crazy airline that I was on, the band that I heard in Havana, the incredible meal that I might have had in Tbilisi. And that, for me, was an opportunity, a kind of storytelling around foreign correspondence that I really didn't see out there in the magazine world.
Let's give everyone a taste of Roads and Kingdoms. You have these different series, which I love clicking on because they're just easily digestible and so varied and random. So the breakfast series.
So we decided to do a daily dispatch. It's a breakfast. Yesterday's breakfast was about eating brains in Erbil in Kurdistan in Iraq. We also had an homage to Tim Hortons in Canada. So kind of from the banal and everyday to the, you know, more ostensibly exotic. It's all the same experience. It's kind of not just about breakfast as the food on your plate, but as a spiritual repast, that first moment of the day, it's a pretty transcendent and, I think, unifying human experience.
There was another piece you had that sort of lived as an annotated map that was bizarre and hysterical in equal parts, about getting ice cream in Mogadishu.
When we had Daniel Howden and Natasha Tay, who were two very good foreign correspondents in East Africa, they had gotten this invitation to head out to Mogadishu and be shown how regular the city life was. Daniel ended up writing a piece for The Economist about that from that trip that was pretty straightforward. But when we were talking to him about what we'd like to see from there, this idea came up of they had been offered to go get chocolate ice cream with the Minister of Defense. And this was supposed to show how normal life had become in Somalia. Of course, to get chocolate ice cream, they had to go through this sort of winding path. We have like 12 checkpoints on the map through Mogadishu in a heavily armed convoy of 5 Department of Defense vehicles, all to make this very sort of silly point that you can go and have ice cream just like anywhere else in the world. The way we were able to tell that was great, which we didn't have to write it as a through feature, even a photo essay. We did it as a Google map. It only exists on these sort of 12 waypoints that have a photo and a little mini essay about what they saw at that part in the city. And, you know, we have the ability to just try to throw stuff against the wall and see what clicks and do a different kind of storytelling.
I loved it because it's exactly what it's like when you find yourself in a difficult, adventurous situation. It can be scary, funny, and with very bizarre kind of takeaways.
I think the unexpected is very, very welcome. From a travel perspective, I think you read a lot of travel media and it's sort of relentlessly positive. It's sort of saying, well, everything's amazing. This was such a fantastic destination and the food was so rich and wonderful. But we all know that's kind of bullshit. Like, that doesn't always happen that way. And I think the closer we can get to the truth of travel, which is exactly that combination that you said of fear and excitement and discovery and boredom, if you can wrap all those into a convincing story, one that touches people the way that they're actually traveling, then I think you're doing something right.
There's a piece about Ajika, the sauce of Abkhazia, that the first paragraph, I just literally was laughing out loud.
Oliver Below is a pretty fantastic writer. He's written actually a number of books from the region, from the Caucasus. And he came to us with this idea that, you know, he wants to go, and he had gone to Abkhazia, which is this breakaway republic just to the northwest of Georgia, fought this horrendous war 20 years ago, War of Secession, is now kind of quasi-independent, unrecognized. One of those places, he'd gone there and tried to talk about the policy issues and the substantive disagreements with their larger neighbor to the south, and found that Abkhazians and Georgians mostly wanted to complain about the sauce. They weren't really fired up about who was the actual progenitor of this sauce and where it came from and who made it better and who it belonged to. They were fighting over it like it was, the DMZ. And I think for Oliver, he said, if you want to really figure out just how dysfunctional and gorgeous this place is, come and taste this sauce and talk to people about it. And one of the things that I love the most about it is he got an interview with the president of Abkhazia. And he asked him about the sauce, and the president of Abkhazia weighed in about who made it best in what market and why it was Abkhaz and not Georgian. And I couldn't imagine a finer way of talking about that region. And I had actually covered it for Time, and I had been there and done a lot of kind of brutal reporting about war survivors and all of this. But that piece by Oliver about the sauce is the piece that I wish I had written.
So it's so good. Nathan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan. It was a pleasure.
That was Nathan Thornburg. He is chief editor and publisher at Roads and Kingdoms. Coming up, more of our favorite interviews from the past year. Stay with us.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Without corn, there is no country. In Spanish, sin maíz, no hay país. It's become the battle cry of the movement to keep genetically modified corn out of Mexico. After a federal court lifted a 2-year-old ban that prevented biotech companies from planting genetically modified corn in the country, a group of Mexican chefs, known as Colectivo Mexicano de Cocina, have organized to preserve the country's 60 varieties of native maize. And now chefs from the outside of Mexico are joining the cause as well. Carlos Salgado of Taco Maria in Costa Mesa joins us to talk about his involvement. Hi, Carlos.
Hello.
So I understand that a lot of people were really caught off guard because as recently as March, there were 4 court rulings that upheld the ban. Do you think it was just pure lobbying? And is there an appeal process that's happening?
Well, I think that obviously Mexico imports a tremendous amount of genetically modified corn from the U.S., the U.S. being the largest producer. Something on the order of 90% of the corn grown globally is a genetically modified seed. So you can trace back the origin of the seed and ultimately the profits and motivations to a handful of companies. Mexico has obviously a rich history and tradition with corn. It's a tremendous market. So I suppose it's no mystery as to why there's pressure to allow the planting of these crops on that side of the border.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about this particular conversation is you're not talking about GMOs from an anti-science point of view. With this issue with Mexican corn, it's a very cultural issue.
Exactly right. And I've often said that our issues with GMO corns in Mexico or here in the U.S., they're not specifically anti-GMO. That's a separate issue which people may have a variety of opinions on. I think, of course, it's too early to form strong opinions either way. But more important is this idea that rejection of those corn economies is more about being pro-culture. It's more about respecting and valuing the longstanding traditions of these products and the unique properties of these crops while protecting them from the rapid economic pressure of the global corn industry.
A lot of the native corns are already selected for certain qualities, I would imagine, for extreme microclimates, given the diversity and the number of different varieties. Are small farmers still being seduced to shift?
I think so, actually. One of the corn varieties that we use, it's a beautiful blue corn from the state of Mexico, Estado de México. It's called Cónico Azul. It's a blue variety, very unique in all of its properties, a beautiful color when raw, a very soft and luxurious flavor to its masa and its tortilla. Aromatically, it's floral and minerally and almost sweet, and it makes literally the best tortilla we've ever had, or anyone that we've shared it with as well. I think that Mexicans have a much different relationship with corn than we do here in the U.S. In the U.S., corn is popcorn and animal feed and high fructose corn syrup. About 40% of corn goes to corn ethanol. So you have a massive industry of corn that is globally, that is really out of sync with the same traditions that are important to Mexicans and Mexican culture, which is food and flavor and the diversity of those corns, different corns being better suited to pozole or some to tortillas, others still for flour. And so I think the shepherds, the protectors of these rare forms are typically small farms that have not previously been a part of the larger commodity corn industry. And so I think that as you've seen in the U.S. and in India and other countries around the world, when there's pressure from outside seed companies making promises about yields and drought and pest tolerance, farmers are willing to give up the regional varieties that they've been growing for, in some cases, many generations. The farmer of our blue corn, it's been his family's crop for 5 generations, and he was very much at risk of switching over to GMO. I'm told that he actually had a test field of a GMO seed because one of his previous crops of his blue corn, which he had pre-sold to a buyer, his buyer pulled out. So he was right on the precipice of sort of switching over to a commodity grain. And luckily, our friend and partner, Jorge from Macienda, who's responsible for importing our corn, he bought it all up and introduced it to all these chefs around the country and around the world.
It's so ironic because we're at a moment here in the U.S. where our grain, wheat, is having this totally new moment of local mills popping up all over the country, new regional varieties being developed, and an appreciation by careful, you know, passionate bakers about what old traditional varieties of wheat can do for their foods just at this moment when Mexico is losing so much with a grain that is so culturally significant. Let's talk about the corn itself and the flavor and how you use it. So are you mostly using this one variety?
We use a few different varieties based on different applications. We have this blue, which we use primarily. We don't assign any particular region to the food that we make at Taco Maria. And so the blue works really well for us for the majority of our tortillas. Beautiful flavor, beautiful texture. We use a variety of yellow called Chalqueño variety in yellow color. It's better than anything that Frito-Lay could make. We call it the artisan Frito tortilla, and that's a beautiful product that crisps up really well. We use it to make chips and tostadas. We use it in batters to make really delicious, crispy, and very flavorful batters for frying foods.
And it's super yellow. It's a beautiful, deep yellow.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you put our masas on the table together, and they sort of look like Play-Doh. We get customers actually often asking us what we've used to color the tortillas, and we tell them, no, that's the color of the corn, and they don't believe us, and then they raise their voices as they think that we're lying to them, and I have to bring out the blue corn and show it to them. But we have a red variety of the same conico that is very sweet and almost a creamy aroma. We use that in dessert tamales. We roasted strawberries and mixed them into the masa for like a dessert tamal, which we'll be bringing back soon, I think. And you know, white varieties, like big, plump, starchy white varieties for pozole. So really there's a wide range of textures and aromas and appearances within these corns. And each of them is best suited for a different application. And, you know, it allows us to not just make a more delicious dish, but also to share our enthusiasm and our appreciation for, you know, traditional Mexican foods.
People are going to be listening to this and they're going to say, how can I get my hands on some of that masa? Can you foresee a day where you start to sell a little bit to the consumer?
We'd like to very much. And, you know, first and foremost is creating a system that works for us to produce in large quantities for ourselves and for other restaurants. Working with Jorge Gaviria at Macienda and working with other restaurants, we work with the amazing Ray Garcia at Broken Spanish. We work with Petty Cash as well. And thanks to that, we were able to invest in a system of producing masa, which will allow us hopefully to scale it even further. Right now, I sell masa, but I don't make any money at it. And I take a little bit of a loss at it in my own restaurant. But that's just because we can't have it any other way. I hope for and I look forward to a day when I can sell you a dozen tortillas warm, fresh off the griddle for you to take home.
Wow. Thank you so much, Carlos. What a great story.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Carlos Salgado, chef owner of Taco Maria in Costa Mesa. We've been talking about the threat to heirloom corn in Mexico. Bros in the Kitchen. It's been a popular topic of conversation this year, but American restaurant kitchens weren't always populated by tatted out, baseball hat wearing cooks. In fact, our modern food aesthetic and celebrity chef culture can be traced to a trio of three gay men, James Beard, Craig Claiborne, and Richard Olney. Writer John Birdsall wrote a piece for the Lucky Peach gender issue titled, America, Your Food is So Gay. Hi, John.
Oh, hey, Evan.
You start off the piece with a remembrance of your neighbors that you had when you were a kid. Can you share us a, a little bit of those memories?
Yeah, so I grew up in a suburb of San Francisco. Our neighbors and my parents' best friends were a gay couple, Pat and Lou, who, you know, had met in San Francisco like so many couples did after the Second World War. And instead of going back to the Midwest, they stayed and they built a life. And in some sense, they were pariahs in our neighborhood. You know, a lot of our neighbors really thought my parents were bad parents for letting my brother and I go over there. You know, they would babysit. We would spend the night. And I really loved them. I mean, I loved them like my uncles. And Lou, who did all the cooking and stayed home while Pat went out and worked, he used to cook for us whenever they would babysit. And he would make these incredible, kind of massive, overly rich burgers with like Roquefort and Dijon mustard and caramelized onions. You know, as a little kid, I wasn't able to eat very much of them, but I loved it. And it seemed to express this sort of magical culture that wasn't about, you know, nutrition or eating well or eating like you were supposed to. It was food as this kind of utter expression of like fantasy and pleasure and having a good time.
Describe their cocktail hour.
Oh, yeah. Every night they had this kind of formal cocktail hour. And my mom used to love to go, especially. And they had these sort of matching club chairs, and they would sit there. They had this little miniature schnauzer named Kurt, and they'd throw them like nuts. And they would drink Gibson cocktails. And I remember them wearing these like matching poplin jumpsuits, you know, belted jumpsuits. And they had these like corduroy moccasins that they wore. And they would get a little hammered, you know, before they ate and tell stories. And it was just fantastic. One of the best things of my childhood.
So now we come to this idea of food and gay sensibility. Is there a gay sensibility when it comes to food?
That's a good question. I mean, I, you know, so when I started cooking in restaurants myself, you know, in my early 20s. And then I also wrote about food, and I started writing some restaurant reviews for a gay and lesbian publication in San Francisco called The Sentinel that no longer exists. And I had this great editor who would always ask me, you know, he would ask all of his sort of arts writers, you know, is there a gay sensibility? Can you find it? You know, can you see it in art or dance or, in my case, food? So that question always stayed with me. And so, you know, talking about sort of Pat and Lou, you know, looking at the kind of impossibly rich, just kind of pleasurable food that they would make, it sort of dawned on me that there was this whole influence of food, you know, new food in America that really had nothing to do with like the sober, frugal, home ec style of food and food writing that had existed, you know, through the 1940s, 50s, even into the 1960s. Certainly James Beard and Craig Claiborne, they really kind of championed a type of food that wasn't about kind of feeding your family economically. It was really about food as this expression of culture in some way, you know, really kind of living this intensely pleasurable life.
When I was a teenager, I started working for caterers here in Los Angeles. And it was that late 70s period of time where Christopher Idone and Glorious Food, which was this iconic Hampton's caterer, was sort of the Martha Stewart of the time, I guess you'd have to say, that everybody looked at those coffee table books to get ideas for appetizers and drinks. And I think about that time as being, you know, pre-HIV, all of the people I worked with on those jobs were gay men, and there was this sort of joyful playfulness that surrounded every aspect of that. What was it like to be, I would imagine, a closeted gay man working in a kitchen at that time?
You know, it must have been horrible. I mean, it's still, oddly enough, the kitchen, you know, despite there being, you know, very prominent out gay and lesbian chefs, the kitchen is still a place where it can be very hard to be gay or lesbian, especially in fine dining. Last year, I had the pleasure to spend a couple of days in Mexico talking with Jeremiah Tower. And, you know, along with Wolfgang Puck, he's one of the first like celebrity chefs of the early 1980s. He was this national figure. And he was gay and out. And it's kind of amazing that he was able to do that. And so I asked him what that was like. And he said it was always very difficult. There were always, you know, slurs, homophobic jokes that he would have to endure, even at that level.
You know, it's so interesting when we think about this beginning of sort of the modern era of, quote, gourmet food, when we talk about James Beard and Craig Claiborne and Richard Olney, and then we talk about this super bro-y culture and maybe celebrity chef-wise represented by Guy Fieri. And you kind of wonder, how do we get from one side of that to the other?
I think the turning point was definitely 2000. And, you know, Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. I mean, I love that book, and I really admire Anthony Bourdain, you know, as a kind of writer and observer. But that, I think, allowed kitchen culture to really veer in this very strict male, extreme food, kind of bro-y way. And, you know, food, the editorship of food magazines, we saw a change there. You know, we went from food magazines that had, you know, predominantly female editors to, you know, today where there are a lot more sort of male editors in top positions than there were back then. You know, Lucky Peach, which is an amazing magazine and which I have written a number of stories for, you know, it really arose as an artifact of kitchen culture, of chef culture. And so it really reflected this kind of male world. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write America, Your Food is So Gay for Lucky Peach was because I felt like I wanted to kind of redress the balance in some way. You know, all these chefs really hoping to snag James Beard Awards. And I kind of wanted to remind everybody that James Beard, you know, didn't come out of this kind of bro-y button-down restaurant culture, but had this very interesting life.
So do you think that the pendulum is actually shifting once again?
I think the perception is changing. Last year, I was at the James Beard Awards, and they played a film about James Beard's life, kind of a short 5-minute documentary, and it was narrated by Ted Allen. They talked about him being a gay man. They talked about him, you know, having been kicked out of Reed College for being caught kissing a man. And so I think there's a new kind of willingness to kind of look at that part of Beard's life. The other thing is that since I wrote America, Your Food is Gay, I've heard from so many people, you know, gay men who really, you know, thanked me for writing that piece and felt like it was really long, long overdue to kind of acknowledge the influence and the presence of gay people in the kitchen.
Wow. Thank you so much, John Birdsall.
You're welcome.
America, Your Food is So Gay. That's the title of John Birdsall's James Beard award-winning article. It first appeared in the gender issue of Lucky Peach, but we'll have a link to where you can read it online at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. I have two words for you. Candy Pants. One of my favorite good food segments of all time is next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. We've come to the finale of this year's Best of Show, and what a finale it is. The story begins with two longtime lovers. Their curious entrepreneurship in the food world has all the trappings of a Scorsese movie, drugs, an evocative soundtrack, and just the right amount of smut. Writer Gideon Brower has the story.
One thing to know about edible underwear, those candy briefs you might buy as a gag gift that you can wear and also eat, they were never originally meant to be eaten, and they were never originally meant to be worn.
We approach it as conceptual art and as a sexual parody.
It ended up being just this gargantuan behemoth. It kind of got out of control.
Lee Brady and David Sanderson are the guys who invented edible underwear. They're also a couple. They've been together since 1967. You'd expect something like edible underwear to have an unusual backstory. But the history here is way stranger than you'd imagine. Here are a few of the elements. Children's theater, cutting-edge food science, disco, Tokyo Rose, a suitcase stuffed with cash. This all starts in the early 70s. David and Lee and some friends were sitting around a big rundown Victorian house they were renting in Chicago's Old Town neighborhood. And this will not shock you, they were a little high.
We were sitting around smoking.
Drinking any green spring wine, apple flavor. We were talking about colloquialisms, you know, like go bananas.
Puff the magic dragon just kind of put it in our minds. And I remembered that my older brother used to say to me, eat my shorts.
Eat my shorts.
Like, buzz off.
We're just howling at that. And then David thought, well, why can't you make them? Why isn't there such a thing?
Now, I kind of doubt David's older brother was the first person ever to say, eat my shorts. And David and Lee probably weren't the first people to think maybe you could actually do that. But where other people might just laugh about it and then forget it, they didn't. It may have helped that this was the 70s.
The early 70s, where almost anything seemed possible.
But it also helped that Lee and David are the kind of guys who just try things. In their early 20s, right after they got together, they started a theater company called The Puck Players.
The Puck Players.
They turned a Nathaniel Hawthorne story into a musical with original songs and a fog machine. They took it to schools, including some in the Chicago ghetto.
Some of the fifth graders would be 6'4". They'd, you know, throw things at us and stuff. We had a little white Volkswagen van.
The Puck Players.
They would always paint over the P and change it to F.
That was just one of their adventures. Somehow they got themselves right in the middle of everything that was happening.
We went to San Francisco to the Summer of Love and came back to the Chicago riots.
They were entrepreneurs. They had tons of businesses.
We did a Halloween show for a radio station. We were also selling Tibetan art. We'd rent out rooms. We'd buy vintage clothing and sell it to flashy boutiques. David was also doing a window display. We started having rent parties. You'd pay admission. We'd have punch made out of Kool-Aid and grain alcohol.
They really were guys who tried things. And when they said they were making edible underwear, they weren't kidding around.
Everybody thought we were totally bonkers.
We bought trash bags. We had a friend, Christina. We would pin them on her and get a design that we would cut out. And then we would string it with licorice.
The early ones were designed exactly like underwear. Tidy whities.
The licorice was the strings. You'd tie it on each side of your hip in a bow. The men's, we actually put a pouch in it.
The design wasn't the only challenge. At the time, there was no product that you could cut like fabric, package, color, flavor, and eat. So they had to develop it themselves.
We were experimenting in the spare bedroom with a potato starch and hydroxypropylmethylcellulose, which is an edible plastic.
It took a while, but they did eventually come up with a product that was both edible and wearable. And they gave it a name.
Candy pants.
In 1975, when they'd made about a dozen pairs.
We had a friend who had a bath shop. He said, you can put them in the front window if you want.
Lee and David say, even though they'd gone to all that trouble, they still didn't expect much. But here's where a miracle happened. A marketing miracle, which may be a minor miracle in the scheme of miracles, but still, people spend years desperately trying to get publicity and attention for things they invent. And the way David and Lee tell it, the very first person who bought a pair of candy pants.
A girl from the University of Indiana bought the first pair.
Her school newspaper wrote about it, and the wire services picked up the story.
It went around the world in 24 hours.
And then all hell broke loose.
I got calls all night long from England, Australia, Canada, Germany, and then NBC called and said, can you be on the 6 o'clock news tomorrow?
Who knows why edible underwear struck such a chord? The mid-70s, post-Watergate, post-Vietnam, in the depths of an economic recession, were kind of a grim period. And candy pants were just something silly and fun. Whatever the reason, orders started coming in by the thousands for a product that didn't really exist yet outside of Lee and David's spare bedroom.
If you would, please, send us 12 dozen candy pants.
And did I mention there were a few quality control problems?
It had to have the right humidity and temperature, or it would just dissolve or get brittle and break.
But they were can-do guys, so they got a factory.
The Willy Wonka factory.
Willy Wonka factory.
We had giant decals of Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, Pluto, Goofy, plastered all over this gigantic wall. We started hiring people. Everybody wanted to work for us. We were fun. We had parties every Friday night.
Lee and David were in the papers. They were on television.
Floyd Kramer and Chet Atkins were watching Johnny Carson, and they saw him talk about edible underwear. And they'd written a little ditty, and they thought, that's it. Let's call it Candy Pants.
It was a wonder product. It appealed to everyone, young and old, gay and straight, prude and libertine. Everybody loved Candy Pants.
I'd like to order 36 dozen Candy Pants, 24 dozen women's, 12 dozen men's. Could you call us back on this and confirm whether you did receive it?
Candy Pants.
We had banana split, cherry, and chocolate.
The doomed one.
Not a good idea. We came up with passion fruit.
We did a mint one, which was green. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Division would not give us a trademark at first because they said the words candy and pants were mutually exclusive, but eventually we did get that.
We had a guy come and he placed an order for 250,000 of them. We were like, what?
We had a convent that actually awarded them at bingo game, motorcycle shops carried them, nursing homes.
Bloomingdale's, lingerie shops.
Anniversary gift, a birthday gift, really big for bridal showers, really big.
We were selling about $150,000 a month in 1976.
We were making a lot of money. We would spend it as fast as we would make it. You know, you're young. You're going to live forever.
Lee and David bought a 7,000-square-foot mansion on Castlewood Terrace with a grand staircase and a ballet studio. They had parties, lots of parties. One thing to remember if you're trying to picture what their lives were like at that time, this was happening.
Disco started to get popular. Donna Summer. And then, of course, the disco ball. And we partied a lot. We were generous, I guess you could say. The 70s was a really unique period. The culture was changing. Gay, straight was starting to meld. We were having a ball. It was just a ball. We weren't foolish, but we had a good time.
David and Lee still had a business to run. And the way they tell it, they were starting to encounter some problems.
We would order like 9,000 pounds of flavoring, and all of a sudden we'd get 9 pounds.
The couple says they were getting squeezed by people who wanted to take over their business and sell candy pants to a different kind of clientele.
These men would come in and buy a dozen pair and sell them in their bookstores that sold magazines like Jugs.
We kept them out of porno stores.
We always thought of it as being innocent and a little naughty.
Eventually, they found they couldn't get the raw materials they needed anymore. So they turned to an unlikely ally, Tokyo Rose.
Greetings, everybody. This is your number one enemy, your favorite playmate.
Iva Tagori, the woman who'd broadcast Japanese propaganda over the radio during World War II, was now running an import-export business in Chicago.
Anything from Japanese pebbles to candy.
That imported candy was wrapped in a transparent edible film called Oblat.
Oblat.
Lee and David thought maybe they could make candy pants out of that.
She kind of warmed up to us and turned us on to somebody in Japan.
So that's where Lee went.
A little town that was a paper manufacturing company. I started using their mixers, and all of a sudden, for the first time, they started seeing blue, yellow, green coming off the rollers. And they started calling me, magician, you're a magician.
Once again, they had a supply of raw materials.
We managed to keep it going.
But knockoffs of their product were already turning up in porno stores. Lee and David say the stress of maintaining their supply chain was getting to them. They had to make a tough decision.
It was 9 years that we were running it.
They chose to sell the rights to their product to a group they'd rather not talk about much.
We were at the lawyer's office, and this like cocaine cowboy walked in. He was like 6'4 and huge, and he threw a suitcase on the table, and cash just flew out of it. And our lawyer slid under the table, and he was so afraid.
The bad news, Lee and David were out of the edible underwear business. The good news, they were rich.
We drove around Florida for 6 months and lived kind of a rock star-y kind of life.
And then they did what they'd always done, everything.
We started up a product called Diamond Jacks.
That's a cross between Cracker Jacks and playing the lottery.
We had a gem in every box.
So far, 28,000 boxes of Diamond Jacks have been shipped. 9 diamonds have been found, and 5 are still out there somewhere.
We came up with a breath freshener called Mighty Mouth Edible Paper with caramel pens for kids, dolls and toys for kids.
I dabbled in doing figurative art for a while.
It's in some museums.
We've rehabbed 5 different buildings.
1 6 flat and several homes.
Lee Brady and David Sanderson have been together almost 50 years now. It seems like they've done everything and been everywhere. But they know if they're remembered for one thing, it'll be candy pants.
It's just kind of become bigger than the both of us.
I do feel like it's like our signature contribution to, I don't know what, to conversation, I guess.
We're very, very proud of it. It's taken on a life of its own. It just goes on and on and on.
We outlived the pet rock.
Candy, candy, candy.
For Good Food, I'm Gideon Brower.
As always, if you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime on kcrw.com or KCRW's app. We're also on iTunes and everywhere else you can download podcasts. Happy New Year from all of us at Good Food. That is Jillian, Camelia, Laurel, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back in 2016 with a brand new episode to usher in the new year.